Hey guys, welcome back to the Dispatch. This is going to be the second part in our ongoing series, Dispatch number 2. If you're returning, awesome. Thank you so much for sticking with us. I really appreciate your continued engagement. If you're brand new, welcome. Welcome to the fight. Stoked to have you here. This week, we're going to be diving head first into the systems that are designed to domesticate you and how to break their grip. You're going to learn today how to render your own tallow, make real medicine at home, and use white mulberry to feed both your animals and your future. Plus, we're going to feature a seasonal wild recipe that you don't want to miss towards the end. And they're going to be the main ingredient in this recipe is going to be coming out in a woods near you very soon, which I'm very excited about. So before we dig into our topics for this week, I wanted to go in and kind of give you guys a summary of what we're about and give you, you know, kind of like a mission statement. And if you want to turn this off and leave afterwards, great. And if not, you want to stick around, then you're exactly the type of person that this is for. You're the reason why I'm doing this. And we can keep going together, keep learning, keep growing, and build this thing right. So the core that we're coming from is that the system is not broken. It's working exactly as it's designed, which is to make you dependent, distracted, and domesticated. Sustainable sedition exists for those who refuse to be controlled by those systems. And we're not waiting to be rescued by it either, because we see through that, right? We serve the disillusioned, the defiant, and the people who are done waiting. The mothers, the fathers, the builders, the fighters. People trying to raise kids who are free, grow real food, reclaim lost ancestral skills, and build something that will actually outlive them. All while the world tries to convince them they're crazy for even trying. They're not helpless, they're not lazy. They're just done pointing fingers and ready to take the reins of their own lives. But they need help. They need the mindset. They need the tactics. They need the systems to make it real. And we're going to deliver that. We're going to deliver tactical content. This isn't survivalist LARPing, okay? This is real-world skill building, from permaculture to parenting under pressure. Unfiltered philosophy forged in the fire and the experience of life, not preachy, not nostalgic, and not soft. A platform, a playbook, and a place to belong. Weekly newsletters, an audio version, a hard-hitting podcast, and visual field notes from the real work that I do in my life to embody this and to make it real for myself and for my family. This isn't just a podcast, it's a war cry. And this isn't just content. It's a mission. It's my mission. And I hope that you can make it yours too. So by building it, by living it, every damn day, that's how we do this. We build our own systems. We grow our own food. We learn financial independence and ways to create decentralized lifestyles. It's about honest work. It's about strong families and deep roots. It's about raising kids like the future depends on it. Because it does. We don't theorize, we do. And we don't beg for freedom, we build it. I am adamantly against centralized control systems that manufacture dependence. I also absolutely despise collectivist ideologies that destroy individual agency, regulatory gatekeepers who kill innovation and who gild out competition who could actually come up with something better than what's already been being done in the status quo, and propaganda pipelines that keep people numb, scared, and blindly obedient. Our promise to you, you won't get fluffy optimism or canned inspiration. You'll get clarity, you'll get grit, and you'll get a roadmap for reclaiming your life, because these are the things that I'm doing that are working for me. And if they weren't, I wouldn't be on here spouting it off to you guys. You don't have to agree with everything that I say. You just have to give a damn about yourself, about your life, about your family, and about your future. and about the future of everyone and every living thing on this planet. So that's it. That's our mission statement. If you're still here, you belong here. So let's kick it off this week. Let's get a little deeper into some of the things we just talked about. We're going to get into our weekly philosophical discussion, our food for thought. This week it is feed, control, and the fight to rewild. Any quote-unquote food that comes in a box or a bag isn't food. It's feed. It's engineered for domesticated human livestock. It's built to keep you fat, sick, tired, and dependent. It's built to keep your kids hyperactive, nutrient deficient, addicted to sugar, and stuck on pharmaceuticals before they even know how to think for themselves. They're not feeding us to nourish us, they're feeding us to own us. The system is not broken. It's working exactly as designed. To keep people alive enough to work and to pay taxes, sick enough to stay compliant, and drugged up enough not to notice how miserable they actually are. All that pretty packaging labeled eco-friendly and heart-healthy and plant-based, most of it all has the same nutrient profile of commercial cattle feed. I'm not even kidding. Look it up. It's cheap to produce, it's easy to market, and it's perfect for keeping a population just functional enough to obey orders, make payments, and never ask real questions. But here's where it gets deeper. Domestication is not just about your diet, and it's not just genetic either. It's also psychological. You don't need to be bred in a lab to be domesticated. You just need the right environment. A culture of obedience, convenience, processed dopamine, and artificial community. Take away discomfort, resilience, and critical thought, and you've got a society that can't imagine freedom, let alone fight for it. Sure, there is a genetic component. Domesticated animals show measurable change in behavior, hormones, and physical traits over generations. But epigenetics is the fast lane. The environment that you live in, the food that you eat, the stress that you carry, the stories that you believe, all of it changes how your genes express themselves. And those changes can be passed on. That's how we got here. But that's also how we get out. If this system can break us down with lies and feed and pills, then we can rebuild by reclaiming our bodies, our food, our minds, and our kids. We can create an environment that rewilds us, one that flips those same genetic switches in the other direction, towards strength, sovereignty, clarity, and action. This is where food sovereignty meets generational liberation. Grow your own, hunt your own, barter with neighbors, teach your kids the skills to thrive and the mindset to question everything. Because most animals, once they escape captivity, go feral in a generation or two. Not because their genes changed, but because their environment did. Freedom is our natural state, and it's not lost. It's just been bred and beaten out of us, and the habits that we've inherited. It's time to reverse that process. One meal, one mindset, and one generation at a time, guys. Here at Sustainable Sedition, you'll find the tools and strategies to help you do just that. So now let's kick off our plant of the week. White mulberry is an absolutely amazing plant. I've got some babies at home that I'm stoked to get in the ground. Here's why I'm stoked about it. So it's not just a tree. It's a full spectrum system builder. It's native to China originally and introduced globally for silkworm cultivation, but it's now a staple in regenerative agriculture for its insane productivity, resilience, and usefulness across food, fodder, and medicine. It's going to bring into your system fast growth. It can hit 10 to 15 feet in 3 years under good conditions. It's super drought tolerant. It's tolerant of poor soil and pruning abuse. It's very deep rooted. It brings up minerals, stabilizes soil, and it drought-proofs your system. It has extremely high biomass production. It makes it ideal for chop and drop and mulch and hedgerows, living fences, you name it. So in a guild, if you're into plant guilds and you're wanting to, you know, make your food production systems replicate natural systems like a forest, this is what it does. These are its roles in those guilds. So it's a nutrient accumulator. The deep taproots mine minerals from the lower soil layers, brings up and has access to stuff that other plants don't. And then when the leaves fall, those break down, and the other plants that can't go as deep are able to access those minerals, right? So it also provides shade. It's ideal for partial shade companions like comfrey, yarrow, or mints. It's a soil conditioner. The leaf drop creates rich humus and supports fungal networks. It's a pollinator and a wildlife attractor. Bees hit its catkin flowers. Birds devour the fruit. One thing I say is don't plant one next to your neighbor's car or next to your, you know, white minivan, because the birds will go and eat these black berries and they will just crap purple seeds everywhere. So if you're going to go for the white mulberry, even though it says white mulberry, it's the berries are actually black. But yeah, just keep that in mind. Keep the purple bird poop in mind. So it's also can be a windbreak, right? Its fast growing canopy makes it great for buffering tender crops or livestock. So again, if you're going to go into guild pairings, these are some plants that it pairs really well with in a guild. So as its understory, you can add comfrey, clover, lemon balm, horseradish. Nitrogen fixers like gumi, autumn olive, Siberian pea shrub, and dynamic accumulators like chicory, plantain, and borage. It also has a food yield on top of all that. The berries are amazing. They're like a long, like almost like thumb length blackberry. They taste similar to a blackberry. They look a lot like a blackberry, but like somebody stretched it out and made it a little thinner. The taste is sweet and mild. They can be eaten fresh, dried, or made into syrup or wine or pies. They're super high in resveratrol, iron, and vitamin C. Birds love them. So do kids. The leaves you can eat when they're young. They're edible when they're cooked or dried. They're mildly sweet, and they've got an earthy flavor. And they're often used in herbal teas, known for their anti-diabetic properties. As medicinal use, you can use the leaves. They contain compounds that help regulate blood sugar, support liver health, and reduce inflammation. The bark and the root bark is traditionally used in Chinese medicine for respiratory issues and edema. Berries support immune function and may improve circulation. Research-backed effects include anti-diabetic, antioxidant, antimicrobial, and lipid-lowering properties. On top of that, it's a livestock fodder plant. It's fantastic for like chop and drop, feed it to your animals. You can coppice it so that it grows just super virulent and it never gets so high to where either your animals can't access it if you're letting them directly forage from it, or you can't reach it if you're, you know, reaching for the new growth and chopping it down to feed them. So it's super high in protein, up to 28% in the youngest leaves. It's suitable for goats, sheep, cattle, rabbits, and chickens or goats. It can be grazed directly, cut and carried, or dried for winter feed. Its tannin content is really low, making it more digestible than many plant many tree forages. Multi-cut harvest potential, up to 4 to 6 times per year in some climates. So you can use it as a cut and carry green feed supply supplement, a silvopasture overstory tree, a fallback weed source or feed source during drought or when grass growth is slow. How we're using it. So I just got my first 2 white mulberries. I've been digging into how best to integrate them into my system. One is going near the rebuilt chicken run so that I can use it for easy chop and drop fodder. The other is getting planted in a spot I've set aside to experiment with actually building a food forest with guilds and doing the whole 7-layer canopy system, right? So I'm really excited for that. And I personally chose white mulberry because of its ridiculously diverse uses: fodder, food, medicine, shade, soil building. And I specifically went with white over the darker variety so that, well, you know, the darker the berry, the sweeter the bird shit, so they say. So I'll keep you posted on how this one plays out in real time and what we learn as it settles into our homestead. So this week's tactic for tough times or good ones. build your home apothecary from scratch. If they can drug you, they can dull you. If they can dull you, they can control you. Rewilding is not just about food. It's about your medicine, too. And it starts with your kitchen. You don't need to be an herbalist. You don't need a degree. What you need is a mindset shift from dependency to preparation. Start where you are. Start with what you've got. Here's how we're reclaiming our medicine cabinet from the pharmaceutical death cult. One homemade remedy at a time. So the first thing you're going to do is you're going to set up your basic toolkit. You don't need any fancy gear. Eventually, you can, if you really get into it and you really want to start getting into, you know, distillations and, you know, making mineral salts and all that stuff, you're going to need some equipment. But to start off, you don't need literally anything other than mason jars. You're probably going to want to use wide mouth just because it's easier to not spill crap everywhere. You use quart or pint jars. Labels and a Sharpie. Trust me, you're going to forget what's what. Ask me how I know. Cheesecloth or clean rags for straining. A small dropper bottle or, you know, a set of small dropper bottles or salve tins for finished products. A dark, cool place to store your creations like a pantry, a cabinet, a root cellar, closet, whatever you've got. Next, you're going to master these core preparation methods. So first off, we've got infusions, which are herbal teas, right? You're going to steep dried or fresh herbs in hot water for 15 to 30 minutes. Use it for calming, digestion, immune support, etc., depending on what herbs you're using. And now we can also get go take that a step further and make a decoction. This, you're going to want to use the harder, woodier plant parts like roots, bark, etc. You're going to simmer roots, bark, or seeds in water for 20 to 45 minutes on like a nice simmer. You don't want it boiling and you don't want it to just be so low that it's steaming off either. These are ideal for things like dandelion root, burdock, or elderberry. Tinctures, next up, which are alcohol extractions. You're going to chop herbs. You're going to cover with 80 to 100 proof vodka or Everclear. You're going to let that sit for 4 to 6 weeks, shaking it every day. Strain it and store it in dropper bottles. Or if you want, you don't have to do that. If you want easy storage, if you want to, you know, turn this into kind of a side hustle where you're selling tinctures in bottles, you can definitely do that. You can go that route. But if you're lazy like me, the longer that you leave those herbals in that alcohol, the process just keeps going. I made a lion's mane tincture a couple years ago, and I just left the lion's mane in there with the alcohol. And I mean, dude, talk about strong. Like, you almost felt like high after taking a little bit of that stuff after it sat there for so long. And I mean, you know, the alcohol makes it so that it doesn't go bad. There's no chance of it molding or anything. That's just the lazy man's way. Do whatever you feel is best for yourself and your situation. So next is oxymol. That's a honey and a vinegar extract. It's great for like think fire cider, you know, and kid-friendly medicine. No alcohol in it. You're going to blend your herbs with raw honey and apple cider vinegar for an immune-boosting powerhouse. Next is salves, topical remedies. You're going to infuse oil, olive oil or coconut, with herbs over low heat. You definitely want to dry your herbs first. You don't have to, but when you dry them, it changes the chemical structure and makes it more fat soluble. When you heat it up in the oil, it's able to more easily extract your medicinal compounds from your plant matter. So you're going to strain it and you're going to mix with beeswax to thicken it up. You can use it for wounds, pain, rashes, bruises, broken bones, depending on your herbs. Poultices are next. Mash and apply. Fresh plantain leaves, garlic, or comfrey. Crushed and applied directly to wounds or bites. So I actually have a story about plantain. I was doing some limbing work one time, and I totally nicked my hand with the chainsaw. I mean, it wasn't terrible. You know, I didn't need to go to the hospital. Maybe I should have gotten stitches, but I'm kind of like a I can't let this disrupt my day type guy. So I noticed that there was some plantain growing nearby, and I had just recently learned about it. So I'm like, screw it. You know, I grab grab a handful of it, chew it up, stuff it in the wound, you know, hold a paper towel over it for a couple of minutes, and like literally, I mean, it stopped the bleeding, and that was it. And I mean, it healed very rapidly. It wasn't like, it's not, you know, some Star Wars medicine that's a miracle, you know, but it does stop the bleeding. It helps your blood coagulate, and it's really, really actually cool how it works. And plantain grows everywhere. You know, it's a weed that people take out of their gardens and throw it. You know, it grows between the cracks and sidewalks. So it's something that literally everybody everywhere has access to. You don't need to go and drop a bunch of money on a lot of these medicinals if you learn where to look. So next is syrups. Sweeten strong infusions or decoctions with honey. Perfect for coughs and sore throats, like elderberry syrup, thyme syrup, licorice root, etc. One of my favorite things to have for my kids during the flu season is elderberry syrup. And one of these days, I'll put a recipe on here for that specifically. It's super easy, and it's just awesome. And I tell you what, when you got a cranky, sick kid who is, you know, just feeling miserable and is maybe making you a little bit miserable because they're so miserable, you give them a sweet spoonful of this honey berry infusion, and it's going to make both of your lives a lot better. Just saying. So next is herbal oils. Soak your herbs in oil, and you're going to keep it in the sun, or you can put it on super low heat to infuse the herbs into the oil. Use that for massage, first aids, or salves. So next, 10 powerful starter herbs for you to stock. If you're just starting your apothecary, these are my go-tos. Plantain, which we just talked about. Nature's Band-Aid, it's antibacterial and wound healing. Yarrow, stops bleeding, reduces fever, and supports circulation. Echinacea, immune-supporting powerhouse. Like 90% of the medicinal tinctures that you're going to go find at, you know, a health food store have echinacea in them. It's just a super well-known, super easy to grow, and it's like an ornamental flower in a lot of gardens that people don't even realize has so many uses. Chamomile. It's calming, gut-soothing, great for kids, help put their asses to sleep at the end of a long day. Garlic. Antiviral, antifungal, heart-healthy, and immune-boosting. Dandelion. It's a liver tonic. Gentle detox. Edible from the root to the flower. I love dandelions so much. And I forget exactly where this word comes from. I think it might be French. I don't remember. Don't quote me on this. But I don't know what language this translates from. But I know that the word dandelion translates to lion's tooth. So I just think that that's cool. So every time, you know, I'm like, I'm going to go out and forage me some lion's tooth. It just sounds cool. Anyway, so calendula is an antifungal. It's skin healing and anti-inflammatory. Lemon balm. It's a mood booster, an antiviral, gentle for kids. And it actually, I take lemon balm all the time because, you know, just for like anxiety and for like nervous system stress, it's a nervous system regulator, which is, I love it. I have a nice warm cup of lemon balm tea, and you're going to be in good shape. You're going to be in really good shape. So then elderberry. It's antiviral, immune support, cold and flu prevention. So now, grow what you can and barter what you can't. So calendula will bloom in a pot on your porch. Plantain grows in cracks in the sidewalk. Ask around. There's probably someone in your community already growing this stuff. You trade eggs for salves. Trade tinctures for vegetables. Barter and build your circle. Forage because the land provides for you. You don't need a garden to get started. Most of the herbs listed above grow wild in backyards, parks, alleys, and roadsides. Dandelion, plantain, yarrow, nettle, cleavers, chickweed. They're all around you if you start paying attention. Grab a regional foraging guide or go on YouTube or Google. Take a walk with someone who knows the local plants. Your ancestors didn't go to Whole Foods. They walked out the front door. So now is the mindset. Stop buying what you can make. Every remedy that you make for yourself is one less dollar you throw at a system that wants you numb and dependent. This isn't alternative medicine. It's ancestral medicine. It's real medicine. All of these synthetic drugs that we have come from organic compounds found in the natural world through plants and fungi anyway. So go straight to the source. And I'm not like one or the other. You know, there are definitely times where you need something that's a little bit more powerful than a flower can provide for you, you know. But all in all, unless you're having like a serious acute injury or illness that you need something that has a little bit more punch, a lot of these chronic symptoms that we experience are much better solved with natural medicine. And it's straightforward, one of the simplest ways to put power back in your hands. So that wraps that up. Now let's move into the tool and skill highlight of the week. Render your own tallow and burn the seed oil lies. Seed oils are the industrial sludge of the modern diet, and they're killing us slowly. Plants can't run away, so they defend themselves chemically. And where do they put the highest concentration of their chemical defenses? In the seed, because seeds are how plants reproduce, and nature protects her kids. Now take that seed, corn, soy, cotton, sunflower, and instead of eating a handful, which would still suck, imagine running hundreds or thousands of them through a violent industrial extraction process with high heat, chemical solvents, deodorizers, bleaching agents, plastic packaging, and then imagine bottling it and calling it heart healthy. Crazy. Crazy. So you're consuming more oxidative, hormone-disrupting junk in 1 teaspoon of seed oil than you'd ever manage chewing the raw seeds. And people wonder why everyone's inflamed, foggy, depressed, and breaking down. Welcome to tallow. Tallow is rendered beef fat, real food used by humans for thousands of years. It's stable, it's nourishing, it's shelf-stable, and it's dirt cheap to make. Why tallow rules? First of all, it's loaded with fat-soluble vitamins A, D, E, and K. It supports brain function, hormone production, and deep cellular repair. It's naturally shelf-stable without refrigeration. It can be used for cooking, skincare, salves, candles, or waterproofing gear. It costs pennies if you get your sweat scraps from a local butcher or farmer. How to render it? Number one, you're going to source beef sweat or fat trimmings. Ask your local butcher. They often toss it. Go to the butcher corner at your grocery store. Ask them about their beef fat trimmings. Ask them about pork fat trimmings. See what they've got. It's going to be like pennies on the dollar. Like I spent like, I don't know, I think it was like $15 and I got like 5 or 6 pounds of beef fat. I went home, chopped it up, made a batch of tallow that lasted us. We didn't buy, butter or cooking oil. I mean, we still buy butter to, put on toast and whatever, but like cooking oil, we had a stock that lasted us for, I think it was over 6 months. So, I mean, and for $15, instead of going and spending $8 on a bottle of disgusting canola oil that went through this nasty industrial process. So that's how we use it personally in our lives. So it has a special place in my heart. So you're going to chop it finely or grind it for a faster melt. You're going to cook it low and slow and let it melt in a crock pot, a stock pot, or a Dutch oven with no water. I know some people will say to add water. I've tried it. Don't do it. It's messy, it's a pain in the ass, and it adds an extra step that's like totally unnecessary. Next, you're going to strain it through cheesecloth or a fine mesh sieve. You're going to pour it into jars or tins and let it cool. Store in the pantry for months. And if you want it to last you indefinitely, you can take some of those jars and stick them in your freezer. Done. So optional, you can whip it for skincare or mix with beeswax for balms. How to use it? Cook it in your eggs, your potatoes, cast iron sears, biscuits. Use it as a base for salves. Mix with herbs like calendula, comfrey, or yarrow. Moisturize your skin. Tallow is nearly bioidentical to like the fats that we have in our skin. So we can absorb it. You know, way better than these, sorry ladies, but these horrible skincare products that everybody's putting on their skin. It's fuel for emergency candles or fire starters. That's old school off-grid resilience right there. So reclaim your kitchen. You don't need lab-processed sludge in a BPA-lined bottle. You need real, nourishing fat that actually supports the life you're trying to build. Take your health back. Stop funding the system that's making you sick and render your damn tallow. Now, as promised, we're going to get into our special, super special seasonal recipe of the week. Chanterelle season is coming very soon, guys. I know that if you're in like Alabama and in the South, I remember finding chanterelles right now, just at the start of, you know, June and July. If you're up in more northern areas like Northern California, where I'm at right now, it's going to be a little while. You'll maybe start seeing some pins here and there coming up in the woods as you're taking a stroll. But for the most part, the bulk of the chanterelle season is really going to kick off in like August, September, and up here because it doesn't get too cold. I've found chanterelles in like January near the coast. So they are probably my favorite wild edible mushroom. Hands down. The flavor is so unique. It's nutty. It's sweet. It's like, it's just amazing. They taste like Christmas, and I don't know how else to describe that, but they taste like Christmas. Do with that what you will. So this is a recipe for pickled chanterelles. I love these things so much. They only come around, you know, for seasonally, right? You don't have access to them all the time. So I was like, I want them all the time. So I'm going to find ways to preserve them and to make it so that I can have my goddamn chanterelles whenever I damn well please. So one way that I use to store them is just simply freezing them. And I will actually cook them down a little bit. You don't want to cook them all the way through, but you want to give them like a nice little brown in some butter. And then lay them out on a baking tray with some parchment paper so that they don't like lump into a giant frozen mass in the freezer. Spread them all out. Stick that baking tray in the freezer so that you have a nice even layer of these cooked frozen chanterelles, right? Then you take that, break them up. So if any of them are sticking together, you break them up, throw them in a bag, throw them in a container, throw them in a jar. And then you've got, you know, just sprinkle out a handful into whatever meal that you need. So that's one way. I have tried to dehydrate them, and I gotta say, man, it doesn't do anything for them. It doesn't do anything for them. It takes away, like when you rehydrate them and you use them after you dehydrate them, there's just something special that's not there anymore, you know? So I'd say definitely go with freezing. But then my all-time favorite way to preserve them is these pickled chanterelles. So when you live close to the land, you start to see food everywhere. And chanterelles are one of nature's finest seasonal treasures. Earthy, nutty, golden, and loaded with umami, they don't last long fresh. That's where pickling comes in. Chanterelle season is soon approaching. Arm yourself to take your burgers, your sandwiches, and charcuterie boards to a legendary level. Your ingredients, and this is for a half-gallon jar. You're going to need 3 to 4 pounds of washed chanterelles, a teaspoon and a half of pickling spice, 1 tablespoon of sea salt, a half pint of vinegar, That is not right at all. Okay, scratch that. Take your half-gallon jar. Once your mushrooms are washed, this is how I do it, just so it's like perfect every time. There's probably other ways to do it. I'm not the sharpest knife in the drawer, so they say. But this is the way that I do it. Once my chanterelles are washed, I'll take them, I'll stick them all in a jar, and then I will fill the jar up with the vinegar up to a moderate level, because when you cook these chanterelles down before you pickle them, which you have to do, they're going to cook down a little bit. So you want to, you know, have it maybe like 3/4 of the way full in the jar, so that the chanterelles can, when they cook down, be submerged under your pickling brine. And when you put the chanterelles in the jar first and then pour the vinegar over them, it's going to, you know, the chanterelles are going to fill up most of the volume of the jar. And what you're going to be left with is like the perfect amount of vinegar to have. And if, you know, you've got some of them sticking out over the surface of your brine after you cook them, that's fine. Just add another splash of vinegar and you'll be golden. You just got to make sure that they are submerged. Otherwise, you're, you know, going to end up with nasty, dried out, weird looking chanterelles. Scratch the half pint of vinegar, use the vinegar to your discretion, eyeball it, depending on how many mushrooms you have. A teaspoon of sugar or 1 tablespoon of honey. I like to use honey personally. 5 or 6 cloves of garlic, 1/2 cup of chopped onion, and 1/4 cup of chopped red bell pepper. A bay leaf, 2 sprigs of rosemary, and 1 or 2 dried cayenne peppers. I personally like to add like 5 or 6 dried cayenne peppers because I am a total sadist when it comes to spice. But the cayenne peppers are optional. You don't have to have any spice if you don't want. So the instructions. Number one, you're going to prep and dry the mushrooms. You're going to cut the chanterelles to preferred size. I actually don't even like to cut them. You can like split them and just peel them apart. And it's very satisfying. I recommend you go that route. Place them in a dry skillet over medium heat, add 2 teaspoons of salt and stir until the liquid evaporates. So the point of doing this, of adding the salt in a dry skillet with the mushrooms, is that the salt and the heat are going to extract the excess moisture from the mushrooms and kind of dry them out a little bit. And that gives them space inside to absorb the flavors from your vinegar brine. Next, you're going to build the brine. You're going to add pickling spice, sugar, and vinegar to the skillet. Simmer for 5 to 10 minutes. Separate the mushrooms and the spices. Pick out the chanterelles with tongs and set them aside. Drain the brine and set the pickling spices aside. Load the jar. Spoon the pickling spice into the bottom first. Then layer in your chanterelles, your garlic, your peppers, your onions, your rosemary, and your bay leaf. I always do it this way. You don't have to do it that way. But if you, you know, put the vegetables and the chanterelles in first and then dump your pickling spices over the top, you're going to be picking pickling spices and peppercorns and shit out of your teeth when you're trying to eat these things, and it's never fun. So I put the pickling spice at the bottom of the jar, and then I like to layer everything in nice because it becomes an art project. It's pretty to look at. And, you know, when you pull out this beautiful jar of layered mushrooms and colorful peppers and herbs, it just, you know, adds more of a wow factor, and it's fun. Load your jar. Then once you have everything layered in there the way that you like, pour in the brine. Make sure everything's fully submerged, add some more vinegar if you need, and then seal the jar and chill it. Stick it in the fridge for at least a week. Then eat like a freaking savage. Put it on, again, like seriously, these things on a burger is life-changing. I'm not exaggerating at all. You won't know it till you try it. From there, enjoy the taste of sticking it to the man, you self-reliant badass. Now let's get into the book of the month. It's the same as last week's Gaia's Garden by Toby Hemingway. It's the same as last week, but by no means any less important or potent of a book. It's an extremely practical, accessible, and inexpensive book for anyone looking to deepen their understanding of permaculture and regenerative systems. Whether you're just starting out or already living the homestead life, Gaia's Garden delivers real tools and strategies you can apply immediately. Hemingway breaks down complex concepts into clear, actionable ideas, like how to design plant guilds. He actually even goes into specific plants that go well together in certain chapters of the book. Build soil naturally and organically, and stack functions in a backyard ecosystem. It's not theory-heavy fluff. It's a manual for creating resilient, self-sustaining landscapes, even on 1/4 acre. If you're serious about designing a system that gives more than it takes, this book belongs on your shelf. So this week's dispatch directory, which is our section that will in the future feature our newest podcast episodes for the week, blog drops, social media posts, any text rants that I feel like adding into the website, anything that I've created over the week that I want to share with you guys will be right here in this section, or a link to it will be. But since we're just getting this thing off the ground, I've got one ask for you this week. Pick one thing from this dispatch and act on it. Render some tallow, mix up a fire cider, plant a mulberry tree, start your apothecary shelf, go harvest some dandelion roots, man. I know you have some. Where are you keeping them? Just one thing. Because action beats anxiety every time. We have so much anxiety. We have so much strife. We have so much of an information overload. It is so hard to keep our heads on straight in this time that we're living in right now, guys. And the greatest tool that I've found is positive, affirmative action. Taking small acts every day that affirm to yourself that you're going in a direction. And what better direction to go in than fighting to rewild yourself? So you can explore the full website at sustainablesedition.com. There you'll find our origin story, the philosophy behind all this, blog posts, and a growing stash of free tools to help you build a stronger, freer life. Keep on checking in. Sustainable Sedition Radio, the podcast, is on the horizon. When it drops, we're going deeper than we've ever gone. Thank you guys so much for tuning in, and I'll catch you next week. Keep on building what thrives and changing times.